We are the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, or ACAM for short.
Hello, welcome to the Papers podcast series for the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, or ACAM for short. I'm Uma Tassi, Professor of Psychology. My research focuses on special educational needs and mental health in childhood and adolescence. All listeners to this, and indeed any of ACAM's podcasts, are eligible for a free CPD certificate. Do please visit acamlearn.org for details of this, together with information on how you can access hundreds of hours of free talks, lectures, interviews, all of which you can also get free CPD certificates for. The web address is acamlearn.org. That's acamhlearn.org. If you're a fan of our Papers podcast series, please subscribe on your preferred streaming platform. Let us know how we did with a rating or review, and do share with your friends and colleagues. The focus of today's podcast will be developmental language disorder in recognition of Developmental Language Disorder Awareness Day, which this year falls on Friday the 18th of October. I'll be talking to Sean Ziegenfuss, lecturer at the School of Health Sciences, Griffith University, Australia. Sean is practicing speech and language therapist and co-CEO and co-founder of the DLD project, which we'll speak about later. Sean also organises the International Developmental Language Disorder Research Conference, which takes place online September of every year. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you. Thanks so much for inviting me.
Can you start by telling us a bit about your background, who you are, what you do, and what got you interested in DLD?
Yeah, absolutely. So I initially got a science degree and was really interested in how the brain developed. And that was sort of my first passion and love, was neurology and genetics and why people develop or develop differently. And then I went on and studied a speech pathology degree. And I really got interested in, again, sort of fusing that brain development, neurology, and thought at that time I was going to work primarily with adults. And the idea of working with children was a little bit terrifying, if I'm honest. But I ended up working with kids, and I've worked with kids my entire career, basically, from sort of 0 to 18. And I'm now sufficiently old enough to have clients who are adults who I work with. You know, because they just keep on getting a little bit older, as I do too. A few years ago, I decided that I'd been working in schools for quite some time, love working with school-aged children, really passionate about education. So I thought, why not go back and get an education degree? Because that's what you do, apparently. And I've been very fortunate to fuse both my passion for speech pathology and education in my doctoral studies. So I've actually just recently submitted my PhD on the educational needs of school-aged children with DLD. Thank you. And more excitingly, I've actually got my examiner reports back this week. So I've busily been tidying things up and sending those back. So it's a busy but exciting time for me, professionally and personally.
Excellent. I hope the examiner's reports are not too harsh and difficult.
No, they're actually delightful. But I think it's kind of all built on the back of just a real love for supporting young people and their families. I was so fortunate early in my career to find a school that was specific for children with developmental language disorder, what we used to call specific language impairment or primary language disorder, or a myriad of other names, and worked there for a number of years supporting young people and their families. And I've always just felt that, you know, DLD has been so severely underlooked in funding and in research and in clinical practice. I think there's a little bit of Australian spirit in there where it's, you know, we fight for the underdog. I felt like DLD was a bit overlooked, and I've just met some of the most amazing people with developmental language disorder who just continue to encourage me and make me want to keep going. And I always acknowledge at this point, as a sort of a positionality statement, I don't have DLD. I don't have children with DLD, but I'm just really passionate about it. And I just think that I've met some amazing people, and I continue to learn from them as well as our clinical and, you know, research works.
For people who are listening to this podcast to learn more about DLD, let's just get into it. What is developmental language disorder, or DLD as we're going to call it?
Really simply, DLD is a lifelong neurodevelopmental condition that impacts a person's ability to understand and use language. And it's the cause for that is unknown. So we've got language systems in the brain that we don't fully understand. We know that there's many, many, many genes that control the development of the brain. And in doing so, we have this amazing acquisition of oral language, which I still, as a father, have just been absolutely fascinated to watch, you know, typical language development up close and personal. You know, we've got, you know, 90 to 90 something percent of children that will just acquire language as if by magic. And then all of a sudden you've got kids like those with developmental language disorder where language just doesn't come naturally. And it's not to say that they can't talk. Often that's a misconception that people think, oh, well, DLD means they can't talk. They can talk, but they can't talk as well as we'd expect them to. And it really impacts them day to day. So the difficulties with language and the day-to-day impact is a really key part of the diagnostic process. And the third part is that it's ongoing. Children with DLD become adults with DLD, but we know that their DLD will impact them at different ages and stages. So the impact of DLD at 5 is very different to 15, which again is very different to 25. And DLD will impact people differently, which we'll talk a little bit about today.
And what is the typical age of onset? When would you expect a child to say, well, this is DLD and not just language delay, for example?
Oh, controversial term in the literature at the moment. I think that one thing we have to acknowledge is that language development in the first few years of life is very up and down. Some children will be plodding along okay, and then, you know, the difficulties will become more apparent when they get to school, when they have to start using school language. Other children, it will be more apparent when they're younger, but we're not really sure what to call it. It's quite different if we were to think about it from a screening perspective compared to, say, the advent of, you know, neonatal hearing screening is such a phenomenal approach to investigation because we can find out from a very young age that a person has difficulties with hearing or not. But with speech and language, we actually really need to start utilizing speech and language. It's almost a bit of a waiting to see. And I know many people are starting to investigate, well, what are those early markers? And we're starting to see some of those, you know, potential early markers, but it's not always clear. I often will say to families that it's more common to diagnose DLD after school entry, and particularly when we know language starts to stabilize at school entry. In my clinical work, it's actually not surprising for me to diagnose adolescents. And in fact, most of my clinical work in the last few years has been diagnosing 12 to 18 year olds with DLD, and they've just missed the diagnostic boat entirely. But I'm hopeful with awareness raising and early identification that we may pick up these young people earlier and give them some good supports, and that hopefully one day we might even be able to pick this up a little bit earlier.
And I suppose part of the reason why people might go through their childhood, for example, and you're picking a lot more people up in adolescence, it could be awareness. It could also be that they present with other types of difficulties. So what kinds of co-occurring difficulties will children, adolescents, and individuals in general with DLD have, or likely to have, or more likely to have? And what are some of the things that DLD is not or is mutually exclusive?
Yeah, well, I'll start with what it, you know, frequently co-occurs with is often we'll see that language and literacy are interrelated. This is something that in my doctoral research we found came through time and time again was, you know, the number one area that was consideration for stakeholders such as parents and teachers and speech pathologists was literacy skills. And this comes through in the clinical work that we do as well, whereby more often than not, I will be doing an assessment for DLD off the back of some concerns around literacy. And I think teachers in particular are becoming better at identifying when children are struggling to read. We've got countries around the world who've got really strong legislation in place now about identifying literacy difficulties. So one of the things that we can do, I guess, in our clinical research and policy work is piggyback off this identification of literacy. We might call it specific learning disorder in reading, might call it dyslexia. So there's lots of research to show that these two conditions often go hand in hand. If you would have asked me 10 years ago, I would have said that a person with dyslexia couldn't have DLD because it's an exclusionary criteria. But we're seeing some beautiful work by Suzanne Adloff and Tiffany Hogan that's shown that actually having both diagnoses is really helpful for accessing services and supports. In my clinical work, I'd say that I'd see children with behavioural needs quite frequently as well, whether they're behaviours that might challenge us. Certainly there are behaviours that challenge me in the classroom. And there are also behaviours that might look more like withdrawal behaviours, where they're kind of pulling back, not participating in classroom discussions, maybe going to the library instead of the playground, you know, so behaviours where they might look different to their peers. And of course, interplayed with all of that is their social emotional well-being. And so I'd be remiss if I didn't talk about the fact that we've now developed some really good understanding that DLD frequently occurs with difficulties in social emotional well-being. But one of the challenges that people with DLD face, of course, is that a lot of the therapies that we use are talking-based therapies. And if you don't have language, you know, the ability to understand and use language like others, your ability to interact and participate in those therapies is, of course, going to be interrupted. So I feel like that's probably the first part. The second part was around what it's not. So one of the aspects of language, of course, is that language difficulties can be present with any number of other conditions. And in fact, when the Catalyze papers, which were really seminal pieces of research that were published in 2016 and 2017 around identification and terminology, the recommendation was that we would use DLD to describe difficulties with understanding and using language for no known reason, and to use the term language disorder when the cause is known. For example, with autism, sensory neural hearing loss, intellectual disability, where these are neurodevelopmental conditions that are commonly associated with language. And I thought perhaps at the time, maybe we were splitting hairs, you know, and really kind of questioned, well, do we need two separate terms? Is it a bit confusing? Could we just use language disorder or, you know, autism with DLD at the time? But what I've come to realize through this work that we do in advocacy, in research, is the power of identity and that label is really about bringing people together and having a shared community. And if you don't know the cause of your language difficulties, you know, using the term developmental language disorder, I often say we add the D because we don't know the cause to the LD, you know, that actually having that identity where people can come together and understand each other and have shared experiences and actually engage in conversation, research, clinical practice around this shared terminology, it's really, really powerful. And I'm so thankful for Dorothy Bishop and the team with Catalyze, because that label has been so important and really effective in bringing people together from all around the world.
And I think the prevalence of DLD is, I think it's around 7%, I think, is what we go for.
Yeah.
And I think one of the things that I find fascinating is it's 7% of people who have DLD, and that's not people who have autism with language disorder or other things. It's 7% of people will have DLD, and that's not the people who are autistic. Like, and it's not the people who have some sort of sensory impairments, et cetera, et cetera. It's 7% of people, just over 7%, who have just DLD is there. Is their thing, and actually the rest of the people will have other stuff going on as well.
Absolutely. I think if I was to look at Courtney Norbury's research in 2016, where we were looking at prevalence, and we've seen several prevalence studies now. We've seen Bruce Tomlin's research in the US looking at school entry. We've seen Courtney's publication in 2016 and others, of course, many, many people involved in these massive projects. But, you know, first authors get right of way here. And then more recently, in even Australia, we've looked at, with Dr. Samuel Calder's research, with the RAIN study data, that's found, again, 6.5%, 7%. But really interestingly, with the RAIN study data here in Australia, we found equitable distribution between boys and girls, which is a little bit different and kind of is, you know, counterintuitive to what we've seen in other epidemiological studies. And I think you're right in saying, like, it is really common. There's some challenges with that. Firstly, from a clinical perspective, if I said to most speech pathologists or psychologists who might be listening in, or even educators, hey, if you put everybody with a communication need in your space, in your clinical practice or classroom together, 3/4 of those people should have DLD based on epidemiological research, and 1/4 have it associated with autism or an intellectual disability or hearing loss, I would say that not only was probably the reverse true, where the majority of people that are being supported and, you know, identified and supported would be, you know, with other conditions, would far outweigh those with DLD. So that's a really big problem that we have to face, that if the epidemiological research suggests they're out there, we can extrapolate to say they're probably undiagnosed. And the kids that I see would say, you know, felt like I was dumb or stupid and couldn't read and, you know, behaved differently. And I felt lonely and scared. And it was through understanding themselves with the label that they've come to really understand what their difficulties are, but also how we can support them. Probably, if I was also to just take it a little bit further, because you'll soon hear, you know, I love talking policy. A lot of people don't get into legislation and policy as much as I love to talk about it. But one of the biggest challenges we have around the prevalence data is when you start to look at 7-point-something% of any population, that is a huge portion of the population that A, is underidentified, So services aren't there supporting them. And as soon as you start advocating, most systems aren't set up to support that many people with a neurodevelopmental condition. It's actually easier in some ways if you've got a much less prevalent condition that you can go in and advocate for funding, because it might be a much smaller bucket of money. In Australia, we've got about 26, 27 million people. And if I go in and say, well, we need funding for about 1.8 million people, and we're a really small population with a large landmass, you know, if we start to then apply that in the UK and the US, it's a really difficult conversation that we face. And that's where I get stuck a lot with policymakers, is actually, it's too many people. And what do we do about that? So I'm always interested, if anybody's listening, in feedback or thoughts on that particular point. It's a really interesting conversation to have.
If we move on to the identification process. So I suppose let's start from, if we have a parent or a teacher, for example, who suspects that the child might have DLD, and I think you've talked a bit about this already. What are some of the indicators that parents might want to look out for, or teachers might want to look out for, or people who work with children on a regular basis? What are some of the things that people should look at and be like, yeah, that might be DLD, I should try and escalate this or refer this further?
Yeah, well, I think it's important to state that in many countries, speech language therapists, speech pathologists, speech language pathologists are the primary diagnosticians. So knowing where to go to access them if you have concerns is probably one point for conversation. In terms of risk factors, we can kind of group them into a few different categories, one of which is, if your child isn't making progress with their communication, particularly under the age of five, and you're a little bit worried, particularly if you've got friends, you've got similar age children, cousins, etc., and you're going, look, they're not probably saying as many words, understanding as many instructions, perhaps they're not really putting stories together in the way that we'd expect them to. That would be a really obvious, I think, to a speech pathologist flag for getting them in for an assessment. Once we hit school age, we tend to see other flags that come up, one of which is, I've already mentioned, around literacy development. Often difficulties with learning to read and language go hand in hand. Not always, but it is quite a common cause. Also, if a child is behaving differently, and this is a big one when I speak to schools around, if you're referring a child for behavioural support, perhaps even as a part of your social emotional well-being and support, consider a language assessment, just to at least consider that language might be a part of the way in which we think about a child, because behavior and communication go hand in hand. So early milestones and listening to those sort of, you know, words they learn, instructions they follow, putting stories together. And once they get to school, it's probably more apparent with their learning, perhaps sometimes their social interactions. However, I've met some of the most pro-social little people with DLD, and you wouldn't think that they were struggling to communicate. But I'd be honest in saying it can be really tricky to pick up. It is an invisible condition. You know, these children do talk, but they just don't talk as well. And they look like everybody else. There's no soft tissue marker where you see them and go, oh, I need to change the way I'm communicating with you. So that makes DLD identification doubly difficult in some ways.
I think also one of the things that I've always thought about is, it's not that these kids don't develop language. They do develop language. And I think it's Courtney Norbury's work, I think, that shows that they do develop language, even primary school, and even maybe at the same rate as those who are typically developing, but they maintain a gap. They maintain the gap. So you might find that these children are going through primary school and their language is getting better, but there is a gap still. So I think even if the fact that they are getting better in their oral language ability, the fact that there's a gap between where they should be, I think, is also something to think about.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it was actually a presentation I sat in on Gina Conti-Ramsden many, many years ago, more than 10 years ago. She happened to be in Australia, and said, we often think about typical development being, if we were to sort of put it on a graph for our listeners, you know, on one axis we might have skill and one axis we have time. And we often envisage it, typical development being like a 45 degree angle, like they just keep on getting better and better and better. But actually, if we were to sort of view typical development as a flat line, and that we get the right amount of skill acquisition at the right amount of time, we'd often see for typical language users or peers without DLD, this sort of flat line for language. And then for kids with DLD, if we track their language skills across their lifetime, there's always a gap. They just never catch up. In the same way that we wouldn't expect all of a sudden somebody who has a physical disability to all of a sudden completely change their, you know, no longer needing to use a wheelchair or to no longer need to use a hearing aid. I think we still have in some circles this perception that because their language is improving, therefore, you know, they'll just eventually grow out of it. But it's not entirely true because they do progress with language, but there's still always this gap. And it's our role, perhaps not to have, you know, I used to think I was a terrible clinician because all of our goals were age-appropriate oral language skills or age-appropriate vocabulary, and then they never did it. And I thought, oh my goodness, I'm a really terrible therapist. I'm really bad at my job. But it would be the same as saying, you know, okay, now let's get out of our wheelchair or let's get rid of our hearing aid because you've had enough of that now. You know, there's always going to be this gap. And really my role is about creating an accessible environment and working with communication partners so that they can support them in those exchanges rather than curing them of DLD. And that's why I love this, you know, social valorization movement, you know, neurodiversity affirming practice, is we're acknowledging that people are just born different. And language difficulties with acquiring language is just a way of being born differently. The problem isn't the person. The problem is the environment and the systems that sit around them that just don't even think about language.
Thank you. So I was going to move on to mental health. So we know that young people with DLD, on the whole, there's lots of variability, but on the whole, they will have poorer outcomes in various aspects, so like education, employment, crime and offending, those kinds of things. But we also know that they tend to have poorer mental health, so being depression, anxiety, emotional difficulties, but also behavioral problems. Should we talk a bit about what that looks like? What are the things that people with DLD experience differently or experience in terms of their mental health?
From my own research, probably the number one area that seems to come through is problems with peers. Interestingly, children with DLD can be as pro-social as typical language users or non-DLD peers. So they actually want friends. And one thing I didn't point out earlier as part of the diagnostic process is they don't have an intellectual disability. They might have low average, average or above average cognitive skills, but they have difficulties understanding and using language. So often the children I see and work with will be aware that they've got difficulties. But in my research, the number one area that seemed to come through was they wanted friends, but they couldn't maintain those friendships. They would seek them out, but really didn't know how to handle it. And often things like the rules of the game moved really quickly. And so they couldn't follow the changes in the game and got frustrated, or friendships evolve and things become cool or uncool and they can't follow along with that. So all of the children that I've, you know, worked with across one particular study reported that peer problems was their number one area, which of course, if you're struggling to have friendships, it's going to impact on your mental health. A lot of, especially when you're as pro-social as your peers in this particular case. If we then start to think about anxiety and depression and other conditions that face the general population, these are conditions that impact everybody. People with DLD are just as likely as the general population to experience those mental health conditions, but actually their DLD exacerbates that. They're less able to engage in support strategies, proactive or preventative strategies that they might be able to use. So you might be in a classroom setting or an employment setting that is quite open about talking about it. But people with DLD often will say things like, I feel like the words are just washing over me. I'm not really getting it. So you might be putting them in place, but they're not actually benefiting and understanding from those more broad supports. And then when we get to an individual-based support, when things are really starting to need intervention, we do it through talking. And talking is the one, you know, one key area that they really struggle with. But I'm really excited to see that we're starting to see some research coming through on how to adapt, say, cognitive behavioral therapy for people who have language difficulties, and how do we make that more accessible. And I'm really excited to see that research coming forth over the next couple of years.
Part of the underlying thing about talking therapies is, I think it's Hannah Hobson did some work on this around the ability to recognize and label emotions. And we know that young people with DLD might struggle to recognize and label the emotions that they're experiencing. And I think that might be the beginning of being able to seek support. If you don't recognize what you're experiencing, be able to put a label on it, then you can't seek support. And if you can, then difficulty with your oral language means you probably can't access the support that's being offered. What is there around helping young people with recognizing and labeling their emotions in the first instance? And then secondly, are there alternatives to CBT? Because I often see papers or calls for research proposals on alternatives to mental health support for autistic people, for example. So is there stuff going on in the DLD space around alternative mental health support that don't rely on oral language?
I feel like I should be flipping this question and asking you more so than anybody else, having just recently read your book. I think that there's probably some conversation here rather than me monologuing. In terms of recognizing emotions, certainly I see in clinical practice that that's an area that clinicians are aware that people with DLD often do struggle with. So labeling and identifying emotions is important. However, emotions extend beyond happy, sad, and angry, and that we actually need to provide explicit instruction around the complexity and depth of emotion. Part of that can be sharing how making things that are implicit explicit. I often talk to my clients and say, you know, I'm feeling really hungry and that's making me a bit cranky. I might just grab a snack or a drink of water or, you know, talking about it. And they're like, oh, I sometimes feel like that too. So even just being a little bit willing to share how you're feeling, making that implicit discussion more explicit is helpful for them. But I think what I see is this gap around depth, and humanity is got a depth of emotion. And so we often don't extend into that depth. And if there are clinicians listening in, I'd encourage them to reflect on their own teachings around that and how we can work on that. I think there's also a challenge in that speech pathologists are the primary diagnosticians of DLD. Most of the research we have is around providing direct intervention by speech pathologists. However, many people with DLD will require multidisciplinary support. So in part, some of the mental health-based supports that a child with DLD, adolescent, adult with DLD might need, might actually sit outside my scope of practice. And I think I need to recognize that sometimes and go, well, how does speech pathology intervention intersect with mental health-based supports? And you're right, there is research coming out in how to support autistic people that don't rely on some of these more talking-based approaches. One strategy that I've been seeing coming through in my own work, and I'll talk a little bit about some co-design that I did just recently, whereby we looked at visual supports. And in fact, visual supports are a really simple strategy for lots of neurodiverse people. They're particularly powerful for people with DLD because if you think about it, language is very fleeting. And I often will say, people who've heard me speak before will hear me say this all the time. If we can make language something that's tactile, something we can touch and visible, something we can see, it makes it something that's concrete that we can interact with. And visual supports are such an easy way of creating a concrete representation of language. So whether it's in drawing, you know, I often use cartoon cells and we draw something out, or whether it's in a visual support to help with comprehension, it creates a concrete representation of language. When I went through a co-design process with some autistic teenagers with language disorder recently, this was in getting the teenagers to design visual supports for adolescents with DLD, because trying to get enough adolescents with DLD to participate in research is hard enough as it is. So I didn't want to chew up my pool, but we got these wonderful autistic teenagers with language disorder to actually design the visuals for the study, and watching them work was fascinating. And they ended up settling on using emojis, which I wouldn't have picked as my visual support strategy, but because it's on their phones and it's something that they use routinely, they ended up creating this great 5-point scale with a happy and a sad face that actually had a colored gradient on it. And so it went from green to red. And for them, it really represented that there is not just block colors, but this sort of gradient of feelings about something. And we utilized that in our study with 11 adolescents with DLD about their experiences at school. And all of the participants said that they found the visual really helpful, because when you've got DLD and you're struggling at school, by hell, it's hard to then participate in research to talk about it. And I think that when we're looking at designing these mental health supports for people with DLD, I think it's going to be something we have to consider.
Thank you. And I suppose the reason for International DLD Awareness Day is to raise awareness. What are some of the efforts that are being made to raise awareness of DLD that you're involved in, but also that you might not be involved in that you know about?
DLD Awareness Day was started in 2017 following the publications of the Catalyze Consortium papers. The original group was called Rally, RALLI, and I have to take my hat off to the Rally, then Raddled, RADLD, Raising Awareness of Developmental Language Disorder team. They did such a fabulous job of just getting people talking about DLD. And at that point, they felt like they had done what they set out to do. And they contacted a wonderful colleague of mine, Stephen Parsons, who's at NAPLIC in the UK, and said, you know, we'd really like to hand this day and Raddled over to you to see what, you know, you could do with it. And I still remember getting a call from Stephen. He's an Australian speech pathologist based in the UK for a very long time. And he rang me and I was sitting out the front of work and he said, oh my gosh, what can we do with this opportunity? And we'd only ever connected through social media. We talked about the idea of having this international group because at that time, to be honest, DLD and even SLI was still something that was very UK centric. And we really wanted to bust out of that UK centric to a truly global perspective. And so RADLD was formed as an international committee with representation from many countries around the world. We started with, I think there were four or five of us, and it's continued to grow with membership changing. And at the moment, we've got representation in Australia and a colleague who's from Hong Kong, you know, Canada, UK, US, and also committees then that have national committees that represent different countries around the world. So each year we have DLD Awareness Day. It's the third Friday of every October. And each year we have a theme. This year's theme is Speak Up for DLD. And we've had many, many, many wonderful themes over the different years since then. And the focus is really around activating the DLD community to share. We know from a paper by Jaehyun Kim that here in Australia, Jay's at Macquarie University, that less than 20% of the general population have heard of DLD, compared to 90 to 95% of the population who've heard of autism, dyslexia, ADHD. So we've got a long way to go to have that more population level understanding, or even having heard of DLD. Because if you haven't heard of it, you're not likely to do anything differently when you meet someone with DLD. So some of those international days have just been phenomenal. We've had Niagara Falls light up locations from all around the world just to shine light on the fact that there is DLD. You see amazing events like symposiums around research into DLD that are hosted in local networks in different countries. You see pop-up picnics where they bring people with DLD together. We've got marathon runners. You know, DLD awareness raising can be as simple as seeing a post about DLD and the hashtag is hashtag DLD Day. You see a post and you share it. And I often say to people, if that is as active as you are in raising awareness of DLD, that's phenomenal in my books. So we often have, you know, amazing reach on DLD Day with, you know, millions of people interacting around the awareness day. But still, we've got a long way to go before DLD is recognized alongside other neurodevelopmental conditions, because it's through recognition that we actually get the policy change, the funding change that we need to best support people with DLD. So DLD Day is really, in my books, a really big deal. But we can celebrate DLD Day any day of the year. We can always talk about DLD.
I think the raising awareness efforts are working, as in it's very anecdotal for me. I haven't done research on awareness, but I know that when I've like in 2018 or I started my current job, around that time when I did talks on DLD, I'd always start by asking who's heard of DLD. And I try and do that still. And the numbers of people who raise their hands as the years have gone on has definitely increased. But that is like, I mean, that's academic circles, but I don't know what that looks like in the general population. But I imagine it's probably similar. But in definitely in academia, in psychology circles, people are more aware of DLD and have become more aware as the years have gone on. Just to, if people want to learn more about DLD, what resources would you recommend?
So there's some really great information available. If you are just wanting to come to understand a little bit more about it, check out RADLD.org, Raising Awareness of Developmental Language Disorder. It's the international group that I'm very, very, very fortunate to be a part of. And we have some great resources, videos, an amazing YouTube channel that people can go on and check out. Of course, there are other organizations doing great local work. I am the co-CEO and co-founder of the DLD Project, which is the peak national body for DLD in Australia. People can go to visit thedldproject.com, and we've got information, resources, and training all around DLD. Used to be very Australian focused, but we now get hits from all around the world. So we tend to be a bit more, you know, global in even our perspective. But one thing you'll notice on our website is you'll never see people with DLD portrayed as sad or suffering. We really celebrate people with DLD. So we always promote it as, yes, it's different, but people with DLD are amazing, phenomenal people. And you know, you will see that in our materials all the time. And if you're interested, we also have our own podcast called the Talking DLD Podcast. I've been a little bit lax over the last few months while I've been working on my PhD, but we're about to ramp up with some great new episodes. So check those out. There's also DLD and Me, which is an organization of academics in the US. They release some really fantastic blogs and summaries that people can access and share. There's also, of course, NAPLIC in the UK, which is a professional association around language impairment, and really bringing educators and clinicians together. And if you're interested in research and perhaps even recruiting and connecting with family and people with DLD, Engage with DLD is an amazing group of academics from around the world who are really trying to, A, make research accessible for people with DLD and those supporting them, as well as connecting researchers with people with DLD. Because at the end of the day, what we really want to do is continue to push our understanding of how we can best support people with DLD, and we can only do that together.
And finally, what's your take-home message for our listeners?
I think it's been said in a few different ways, but DLD is one of the most common neurodevelopmental conditions that people will face. If you see a person who is struggling to communicate, struggling at school, maybe they have difficulties with their behavior or their mental health, if you can just think that language might be a possible cause, it may mean that somebody who previously wasn't identified will be identified and get the right support. And the stories that I am so privileged to hear from people with DLD, and this is coming from a background of being very anti-labels and the idea of, you know, labeling people and why do we need labels, has been that when you listen to people with DLD share their experiences where they've come to understand themselves and what their needs are, you know, I've had children who've been on the brink of their mental health. These are children who I did not think would be able to come back from where they were in a very dark, scary place. And it's been through a very supported identification process and explaining to them what their condition is. They've gone on and completed their high school studies. They're gainfully employed, happily in relationships. And I think for me, it's their success that continues to drive me forward so that people with DLD can be identified and supported and live their life of their own choosing, not just the one that's laid out for them when they don't even know what's going on.
Thank you so much, Sean. Fascinating conversation. For more details, please visit the ACAM website, www.acam.org, and Twitter at ACAM. ACAM is spelled A-C-A-M-H. And don't forget to follow us on your preferred streaming platform. Let us know if you enjoy the podcast with a rating or review, and do share with your friends and colleagues.